Very much for inviting me to come here. I guess Richard, I represent the enemy in some sense because we're trying to make machines that are using these quantum effects. So to pacify you, I try and put my Union Jack cufflinks on, and I have a Union Jack phone, so I don't look too threatening. So what I want to talk about is the state of the art in quantum annealing machines and some possible applications to cryptology. So I'm going to talk a little bit about our particular hardware, an RDWave machine, and which is currently the largest quantum annealer available in the world, and some address some of the questions that people are asking about this machine. Is it really quantum mechanical, and is there a quantum speed up? And then I'm going to talk about some changes that are coming in the next version of the quantum annealer, which will be released at the beginning of next year. So what is quantum annealing? Well, this to people in cryptology who maybe don't know this, I thought this would be helpful. So the inspiration for quantum annealing came from this old theorem of quantum mechanics called the adiabatic theorem that says if you start a quantum system off in the lowest energy state of one Hamiltonian and you slowly transform that Hamiltonian to another form, and if you do that transition slowly enough, you'll stay in the lowest energy state of all the Hamiltonians passed through. So to make a computer out of this, if your initial Hamiltonian is a ground state that's easy to get into, which you obtain by applying a large transverse magnetic field to a set of spins, so that you create an equal superposition of all possible solutions as a starting state, and then you express your problem in a Hamiltonian so that the lowest energy state of the problem is the optimal solution, you turn off the you turn off the transverse Hamiltonian as you turn on the problem Hamiltonian, and you're carried to the solution of your computation. So that adiabatic theorem applies the case when you go really, really slowly. To make this into a quantum annealer, we relax that need to go slowly. In fact, we find empirically and now theoretically, thanks to Ed Fahey and Peter Shaw and Nishimuro, there's two papers recently that show that repeating this process quickly many, many times is actually better than doing it slowly once. So it's actually starting to get some theoretical justification for quantum annealing as preferable to adiabatic quantum computing. So intuitively, what's really going on here is that the problem Hamiltonian defines an energy landscape, and the best solutions to your problem correspond to the lowest points in the landscape. And every computer algorithm in human history, no matter how clever it was, has been confined to solve this problem by exploring the surface of this landscape in a more or less intelligent way. What the quantum annealer does that's new, it allows you to use quantum effects to tunnel through these hills to get from one local minimum to a better one. And there's actually several quantum effects we use in our system. The first one is superposition. This is needed to put the system in the starting state where all solutions are equally likely. Second one is entanglement, which occurs during the annealing process. And then the third one, which is the one we use the most, is quantum tunneling, where the particle can actually go through a potential barrier and come out on the other side. So it doesn't have to use a thermal fluctuation to go over it. Okay. So what's the state in quantum annealing hardware today? This is our current product. It's called the D-Wave 2. This large box here is about 10 feet by 10 feet by 10 feet tall. It's actually the box itself is an important part of the system. It forms essentially a big Faraday cage that shields all radio frequency interference from the outside. And inside, we have a dilution refrigerator, which also has mu metals to shield the magnetic field from the Earth. And we actually make the magnetic environment in which our processor sits to be one of the most magnetically quiet places in the universe. It's less than one nanotesla in each of three dimensions. We also cool the chip down to 20 millikelvin, which is 150 times colder than deep space. So if you were sitting out in outer space, it's too hot to operate this chip. What the chip looks like, if you zoom in on it, the quantum chip itself is this square, sort of shreddy-like looking object. It consists of an 8x8 array of a repeating unit cell structure. And to the right, there's superconducting classical logic used for communicating with the chip at cryogenic temperatures, and also some test structures, because when you make this chip, it comes out in, as a six-layer device made of niobium. And if you want to probe a chip to find out why it may not be functioning correctly, you can only see the top layer. So when we make a chip, we make each layer independently next to it, so that when we get a device back, we can probe all of the components of the chip. And that's allowed us to develop things very, very quickly. If you look at that chip under a microscope, you see this repeating unit cell structure more clearly. In this diagram, the red rectangles correspond to the qubits. These are loops of niobium wire. And where those two loops cross, we put a coupler. So the topology that this induces is this graphical structure of a repeating unit cell. Now, critically, what's very important is this graph that the chip implements natively is non-planar. And that non-planarity means that the problem that the chip solves is intrinsically an NP-hard problem. And then to program the chip, we use the fact that there are efficient mappings from one NP-hard problem to another. Namely, we map from the NP-hard problem you want to solve to the particular NP-hard problem the chip implements natively. Okay. The mathematical problem that the processor solves is this minimization. So you basically have a very simple icing form for the Hamiltonian, a simple energy function. The SIs correspond to spin variables that can be plus or minus 1 for up or down. And the Hs and Js are real numbers between minus 1 and plus 1, specified in the current device to 4 bits of precision. So it's a pretty crude specification at the moment. If you go and look in the literature for ideas of how to map problems to a form that runs on the chip, you can look in the icing literature, or you can look in another literature called the Kubo literature, quadratic unconstrained binary optimization. And the difference is, in the Kubo literature, they use variables that are zeros or one, and you can get those by a simple transformation from the spin variables. So there's two bodies of mathematics you can go to look at for ideas for how to map problems to this chip. Now, although the chip itself implements a particular fixed graph topology, you're not restricted to only posing problems that correspond to that topology. In particular, you can embed a complete graph in this graph that the chip implements natively. The price you pay is that if you want to embed a complete graph of n nodes, you need a chip with n squared qubits to do that. But from the point of view of freedom to express any problem, any spin problem you can express, you could, in principle, you can express any kind of graph you want with this architecture. And the way we do this, we chain qubits together. So we make this one extended qubit, and then you can connect that qubit at many different points. Now, anyone making a quantum computer is likely to have the same kinds of issues we've had to address when you scale things up and you want to express arbitrary topologies and things like that. I should mention that a team at NASA Ames recently looked at a very interesting set of complete icing graphs run on our hardware, and they found an advantage compared to what you can do classically in finding the ground state of those complete graphs. So this is not just a theoretical possibility. People have actually embedded complete graphs in the chip, although they're quite small at the moment. So what kinds of computations is this machine good for? It's basically good for discrete combinatorial optimization and then sampling, so getting lots of solutions to a problem. So as I said, the way we operate the chip is that we don't just run the computation once slowly and read out an answer. We repeat the same computation many times very, very quickly. And that gives us a lot of different answers to the same problem. It also is good for applications that build on those capabilities of optimization or sampling, such as finding approximate solutions. So when you run this chip, it doesn't always give you the global optimum. Sometimes it gives you a local optimum that's very close to global. And the speed at which it can give you those close to optimal globals, close to global optima, is extremely impressive. It's also good at counting solutions, because you get lots and lots of solutions back every time you run the chip. We generate about 1,000 solutions a second from the chip, so it's very good for estimating the total number of solutions. And then other things such as constraint satisfaction and machine learning that rely on these optimization and sampling capabilities. So one example of applying this annealing architecture to cryptology, and it's not really the only one, but this one's a simple one to explain, is in actually factoring integers. not using Shor's algorithm, it's using a constraint satisfaction approach. And the idea is very simple. You imagine that you wanted to multiply two numbers together written out in binary. You get a multiplication like that in which the output bits are related to sums and products of the input bits with carries. Okay? So conceptually what we do here is we create a circuit for a for multiplying two integers together, written out in binary form, and then you fix the output bits to be the bits of the number that you want to factor, and then you solve for all the implicit constraints to find the input bits that would give you that output. So you need three kinds of gates to make that circuit. You need AND gates, half adders, and full adders. And each of those gates, we associate a little tiny penalty function, one of those little Hamiltonians, so that when that energy function is zero, the combination of bit values satisfies the logic of that gate. And then we add all those energy functions together and minimize the whole thing to solve the problem. In terms of the gate count, to make a circuit, you need, if it's an L-bit number you're trying to factor, you need L squared AND gates, L half adders, and binomial L, L choose two roughly full adders to that. So let's just focus on one of the gates and show in more detail what I mean. So if you look at an AND gate, if the penalty function has this form of H AND, then the bit values that satisfy the logic of an AND gate are green, and the ones that don't are in red. You'll see for the green values, the penalty function has a value zero, and for the red values, it has a value that's greater than zero. So anytime you minimize that H AND function to zero, you are guaranteed to find a tuple of inputs and outputs which satisfy the logic of the AND gate. We basically do that for each of the gates in the multiplication circuit and then minimize to find bit values that satisfy inputs and outputs. So with the current Chimera architecture, if you wanted to factor a 2n plus 2 bit number, you'd need 32n squared qubits to do that. But with a simple change to the architecture, which we know how to make but we haven't made it yet, you could factor a 2n bit number in 2n squared qubits. And there's probably a lot of other optimizations you could do. So this isn't challenging, threatening to modern cryptography today, but we have been able to factor all the numbers that are reasonably factorized, all the numbers you'd want to factor, up to 16-bit numbers, which is way bigger than what other people have done in other quantum computing hardware today. And what I should say is the hardware is growing at quite an impressive rate. Towards the end of this year, we're up to about 1,000 qubits now. And by the end of next year, we'll be releasing a 2,000-qubit chip. And with architectural changes, you know, the essential power of the machine could advance quite a lot, because we're not wedded to any particular architecture. We can change everything's up for grabs. So what do we know about quantum annealing, more relevant to this workshop? Well, really, this idea of quantum annealing came about through a lot of work of theoretical physicists initially. And so there's a lot of theoretical physics papers about proving that there should be an advantage to quantum annealing over thermal annealing. And that work was done in the 1990s, essentially. And then there were physics experiments on naturally occurring bulk materials that confirmed experimentally that these theoretical predictions were correct and that quantum annealing was indeed better than thermal annealing for those materials. Then, around 2001, Ed Farhi and a group at MIT came up with this conceptual idea for how to make a computer out of this quantum annealing process, called an adiabatic quantum computer. And then D-Wave, around 2010, 2011, we demonstrated a large-scale programmable device. So whereas the early experimental work was on bulk materials, our work was on a programmable device. So the key questions which, you know, have come up was, is the device we've made really quantum mechanical? And does it yield a speed-up over what you can do classically? So I'm going to give you a synopsis of where we are on that. So in terms of evidence for quantumness, one of the quintessential pieces of quantum mechanics that you need to make quantum computing devices, as Simone mentioned, is entanglement. We have a paper published in PRX now that shows that we generate a significant amount of entanglement throughout the critical stages of quantum annealing. we actually use three different measures of entanglement: concurrence, negativity, and one witness based on magnetic susceptibility. The solid lines are the theoretical predictions we have for what those quantities should do, and the data, experimental data tracks those theory curves pretty well. So we have a pretty good evidence, I think, that there is significant entanglement in our chips throughout the critical stages of quantum annealing. In addition, there's a paper from UCL that came out, and the paper from UCL shows that the D-Wave device fits a quantum mechanical model across a range of different effective temperatures, whereas no classical device so far proposed for the D-Wave chip does that. And if you've been following the literature closely, you'll know that there's been a bit of a tennis match going on between IBM and UCL, and because IBM had proposed if they add noise to their model, then the model would fit the quantum mechanical model. And UCL has now rebutted that as well, so that there is no classical model that currently describes the behavior of the D-Wave device, whereas there is a quantum mechanical model that fits it very, very well. So there's more good evidence of quantum mechanical effects. And then more recently, there was a paper from the USC team that showed that you can do a kind of error correction in the annealing model that uses both classical repetition code and a modification of the Hamiltonian built on the stabilizer of the repetition code. And that shows that you can make an error correction scheme for a quantum annealing that uses quantum mechanical effects and works better than a purely classical error correcting scheme alone. And then just last week, I was at the SETI Institute in Mountain View. We had the first D-Wave Users Colloquium. And at that talk, the Google NASA team described a paper that they are about to release, which shows a functional role for quantum tunneling at a large scale in the D-Wave device. So I think at this point, evidence is pretty firmly in our court that the device we've made is really quantum mechanical in nature. So then the other question that comes up a lot is, okay, so you've made a device, and people generally seem to accept it has quantum mechanics going on in it now, but is there a quantum speedup? So the reason some people think there might not be is really these three broad categories of theoretical criticism I've heard. So the first is that the Hamiltonian we employ is of a special form. It's called a stochastic Hamiltonian. What that means is that the off-diagonal elements of the Hamiltonian are real and non-positive. And that Hamiltonian fits some other quantum mechanical models, such as the bosonic Hubbard model as well. And the question is, can a quantum computer with the restriction to only being able to access a stochastic Hamiltonian, is that fundamentally more limited than what you can do with a general quantum computer? Clearly it is more limited, but is it more limited in a profound way? So people looked at whether they could simulate a stochastic Hamiltonian system efficiently classically. And what they have been able to do so far is to show that in certain special cases you can. But in those special cases, you have to introduce assumptions to allow the proof to go through, such as the fact that all the couplings in the system are ferromagnetic, or such as the Hamiltonian has to be frustration-free. And what you find is when you map real problems to the annealing form, the Hamiltonians you get are never of that form. They never only have ferromagnetic couplings, and they're never frustration-free. So for the kinds of problems that arise in practice, the hard problems, those conditions don't appear to apply. Another theoretical objection people have raised is that Sake from IBM shows a polynomial time approximation scheme so that you can actually, in polynomial time, you can get the ground state energy of a chimera structured problem. The problem with a PTAS is it's n, which is linear in the number of qubits, but it's exponential in 1 over the approximation, right? So if you wanted to get to with 1% of optimality, epsilon will be 0.01. So your prefactor would be 2 to the 3200, which is 10 to the 963. So it's an interesting theoretical result, but in practice, it's completely useless, essentially. And then finally, more recently, there was a paper which we got a lot of press from Matthias Troyer, basically showing that for a particular class of problems, he didn't see any speed up relative to what you could do on the classical machine. What we now know, thanks to a paper by Kath Draper, that particular class of problems has the property that it doesn't have a finite temperature spin glass phase transition, which means that for a classical simulated annealing, you can go straight to the solution for those problems. That's essentially too easy. The problem can be solved so quickly, there's no opportunity for quantum annealing to have an advantage. So to see how that sort of makes a difference, our colleagues at Google looked at a different class of problems. So on the left, you see the Ronno experiment, in which you have this this simple problem that lacks a finite temperature phase transition. On the right, you have a problem that's characterized by having a lot more local minima and a few global minima. And you see in that case, you can get a very big difference between the scaling of quantum annealing, which is the dashed line, and the scaling of simulated annealing, which is the solid line. But what that really showed, I think, is that we need more insight into the structure of problems that are hard for annealing systems. And so we've looked to the field of computational phase transitions for inspiration here. So 3SAT is probably the most famous of all the NP-hard problems. What we find is there are two variants of 3SAT that are actually easier to map to the topology of the chip. One is called not all equal 3SAT, and that basically says for each clause, you can't have all three literals having the same truth value. And its big brother, which is 2 in 4SAT, essentially it's a 4-satisfiability problem in which in each clause, exactly 2 of the variables has to be true and 2 have to be false for the solution to be accepted. So for those problems, if you compare the number of anneals needed for quantum annealing on the vertical axis to the number of anneals needed for simulated annealing on the horizontal axis, you see as you scale up to bigger problems, that you start to get a nice separation between quantum and thermal annealing. And the same is true for 2 in 4SAT as well. And independently of this, we've been working on some applications of these problems in other areas of cryptology as well. So we also need better metrics of characterizing performance. So one thing I always like is this benchmark we did with one of our customers who bought one of our systems. They wanted to know how the quantum annealer approached optimality. And they had a model, theoretical model, of how they thought algorithms should approach optimality. That was given by a formula, given by the solid lines. And the yellow and the red and the gray curves correspond to three classical algorithms approaching optimality. And the red curve corresponds to what the D-Wave machine did. And what you'll notice about this is that nothing happens for all of this time in the D-Wave machine, because what's really going on at this point is we're telling the machine what the problem is it has to solve. At this point, you turn the machine on, and the first few problems, samples it draws, are of a better quality than what these classical ones have found so far at that point. So if you relax the problem from being finding optimality to finding something close to optimality, we think we can do really well at those problems. So here's an example of that. On the vertical axis, it's the average amount of computation time. The horizontal axis is the size of the problem. The green curves correspond to a famous algorithm, now famous algorithm that Alex Selby developed, which was designed to compete head-to-head with the D-Wave machine. And the top curve corresponds to the time to optimality. And the second green curve is a time to within one energy eigenstate of optimality. And you see that for different situations corresponding to increasing number of bits of precision. And what you notice is that for the high bits of precision problems, the D-Wave machine was doing relatively poorly for those problems. But that's because for those problems, when you're trying to solve for optimality, you're really hurt a lot by intrinsic calibration error or misspecification of the problem. When you take that away by relaxing the requirement to solve for optimality to solve for near optimality, the scaling of the D-Wave machine gets a lot better. And it looks actually pretty flat across all levels of precision. So one of the lessons learned, I think, is looking for example problems that don't require full optimality but just near optimality is a good fit for the hardware. And in addition, we're working on reducing the intrinsic calibration error. So what's coming in the next processor? Our current processor that everybody has is a version 6 Vesuvius. One thing we did internally was develop a version 7 Vesuvius that had some design changes in. Now what's interesting about this comparison, this is the same problem solved on version 6 versus version 7. And what you'll see is that for exactly the same set of problems, the scaling looks different. So what that tells us is we haven't hit any fundamental limit on the fundamental mathematical scaling of quantum annealing, because you shouldn't be able to change the slope of the scaling curves by technology alone. But what the difference is, in version 7, we've removed some of the noise that was present in version 6, and you can see that you get a better scaling result. So then we've what the other design changes we have coming in the chip is the current D-Wave chip could only anneal at 20 microseconds. And what we notice is that if you made the annealing time shorter and shorter and shorter, the performance kept going up, contrary to a lot of people's expectations in the field. So in the next chip, we're going to have an annealing time that can go down to 5 microseconds to investigate that. We've also accelerated the programming time. So instead of having a serial line to specify the problem, we have a parallel line so you can pose the problem more efficiently. And the chain length basically is related to what's the most complicated graph of arbitrary topology you can embed in the chip. In the old chip, that was limited to about a chain length of 6 for them to work reliably. In the new chip, we're going to a chain length greater than 12. And then some of the other things we're going to add, as I mentioned before, there's some evidence now that there's a new kind of error correction you can do for quantum annealing machines. And we're going to put in a lot of error correction into our system that will improve performance quite a lot, too, I think. So this is our new chip. This is actually a wafer of 3 generations of processor. The little tiny square is the 512-qubit chip. The intermediate one is an 1,152-qubit chip. It's a 12 by 12 array of 8-qubit unit cells, which is why you get the funny number. And there's also a generation which we expect to be commercializing about a year from now, of 2048-qubit chip. That's starting experimentation with that as well. The first Washington chip is cold, and we got some experiments on it over summer. And this was an interesting case because this was a class of problems investigated by Itai Hen at USC called frustrated loop problems. And for those problems, we found on the Washington chip, which we calibrated, I think, about 933 qubits for the first chip we got cold. And for those problems, we see a better scaling of the quantum chip on those frustrated loop problems than you see in Alex Selby's solver, which was designed specifically to compete with the D-Wave machine. So that's all I wanted to say. Thank you. I think the evidence for quantumness is pretty strong now that we have a lot of independent studies pointing for quantum mechanical effects. And the new Google paper, which will be coming out, I hope, within a month or so, shows that those quantum effects play a functional role in the computation at scale. It's a very interesting paper. I think that we need to find new sets of problems that are challenging for the hardware and understand what problems are easy and what problems are hard for this kind of computer, and look at different kinds of metrics, not just time to global optimality, but time to close to optimality is another kind of metric to look at. Okay, thank you very much.
Does anyone have a question?
Perhaps one non-mathematical question. And this is on the slide that with your Washington version 2 machine, the temperature is lower than your present machine. Is that going to be a potential problem?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear what you said.
In the previous slide, where you had the operating temperature,
yep.
Washington version 2 was, I think, below 15
millikelvin,
i.e., had to operate at a lower temperature than your present machine.
The, well,
the potential problem in that direction as you gradually scale up.
You mean do you have to keep reducing the temperature?
No.
Well, you can only go to zero temperature.
Well, right? I know. But the
closer you get to zero temperature, the more your Boltzmann samples are biased towards the lowest energy solutions. So our goal is to make the fridge operate at as low a temperature as we can physically manage. And there's various constraints in doing that, right? So you have to communicate with the chip, and the act of communicating with the chip requires some energy. So we have made a lot of advancements lately on new kinds of communication lines to the chip that don't impart any more energy than absolutely necessary. Yeah. So is there a question over here?
Okay.
All right, thank you.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Not quickly.
Yeah, so could you, so I was particularly interested in your brief allusion to improved fault tolerance
right
on the chip. Could you enlarge upon that a little bit? You were saying that a particular thing that's recently emerged was exciting.
There's several things you can do to improve. So a lot of things you can do to improve performance. So you can reduce the noise in the chip. You can operate at a lower temperature.
Sure.
You can, when you have these chains, if you get a solution back in which the chain criterion is violated, you could do a majority vote on the chains and impose that and then test that solution. You can take a solution from the chip as a candidate to feed into a heuristic search algorithm and localize from that point. And then at USC, what they did was they invented a new kind of error correction technique, which is basically they have a replication code for the system, and on top of that they have a Hamiltonian that uses the stabilizer of the replication code. So they get a quantum error correction scheme specific to quantum annealing, which is different from what you do in the gate model world. So there's many things you can do to improve performance.
Okay. I guess I need to read that. I had the impression that Troyer had a look at replication-based fault tolerance, actually working with a student of mine, and hadn't seen much improvement, but it may be that it's different.
So this isn't simple replication code. That would be classical. This is replication code with an extra quantum twist.
Sure. Okay, I'll take a look. Hang on.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.